So this morning, let's start with a short meditation again. So finding a nice, comfortable posture. Letting go of any external distractions. Simply allow your awareness to descend into your body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And use the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Setting the body in a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. And if you find it helpful, you can take 3 slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. And then allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. and then preparing the mind, setting it in a state of ease and relaxation. By not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future, in particular letting go of any expectations for this meditation. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And now with your eyes at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you, your eyes soft and unfocused, as if you were daydreaming. And now bring your attention to your own mind, and simply observe your own mind, and whatever is arising in your mind. Thoughts, emotions, memories, images. Simply observe these mental events as they arise and pass, without following thoughts, without trying to get rid of them. Simply observe them as they arise and pass, without grasping onto them, without becoming distracted. you're new to this practice and you're not sure what to focus on, or you're simply becoming spaced out, then every now and again, deliberately generate a thought. Any thought will do. And simply watch that thought as it appears in your mind. And then simply watch it as it disappears back into the space of your mind. And then keep your attention right where it was. And simply wait for the next thought to appear in that space. Now, if you found that you've got caught up in some thought and got carried away by it, then the first thing to do is to relax and then release grasping onto that thought and then very gently return to focusing on the mind and whatever is appearing in the mind. So relax, release, and return. or if you find that you're simply becoming dull or spaced out, then arouse and refresh your focus on the mind. Now release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment, simply resting in awareness itself. Of course, all sorts of appearances will continue to arise, but now pay no attention to any appearance. Simply rest within luminously clear awareness. And so again today, to begin our discussions, let's recite the Heart Sutra together, so that again at least we're starting to become familiar with the words. The Heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. Thus did I hear at one time, the Bhagavan was dwelling on massive Vulture's Mountain in Rajgir, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom, and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Then, through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Sharadvatriputra: Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form, form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. No visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element, and so on, up to and including no mind element, and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly, completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth, since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared: Tayata Om Gati Gati Paragati Parasamgati Bodhisvaha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that, it is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan having thus spoken, the Venerable Sharadvatriputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety along with the world of gods, humans, asuras and gandhavas were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. So before we continue on where we left off yesterday afternoon, let's do a short review of what we've covered so far, just to keep that sort of fresh in our mind. So of course here we're looking at the Heart Sutra, which is belonging to what's called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, the teachings coming from the second turning of the wheel of Dharma, mainly taught in this area of Rajgir. And in these teachings, the Buddha is describing the nature of reality, his most subtle understanding of that, that this idea of emptiness or shunyata in Sanskrit, the fact that nothing exists independently, there is no independent me or independent objective world. And in this Heart Sutra, the word heart, of course, means essence, meaning it contains the essence of all of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings in very few words. It's very condensed. And this, as we saw, this Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, the Heart Sutra, the discourse is taking place in this place called Vulture's Peak, a small hill outside of Rajgir. And of course, the Bhagavan, the Buddha, is there. Together in the audience, a great community, a great number of monks and bodhisattvas. Also, we have Avalokiteshvara present, who's appearing as a high-level bodhisattva. And to the audience, it appears as if the Buddha is absorbed in meditation. But of course, he's also aware of everything that's going on around him. Avalokiteshvara is also contemplating this Perfection of Wisdom practice, the practice of emptiness. And it's said here, he's coming to understand or see that the five aggregates also are empty of inherent nature, meaning not just the person, there's no person with any inherent nature, but also there's no inherent nature in the basis of the person, the body and the mind, the five aggregates. And then what we're seeing is that it says through the power of Buddha, meaning that through the power of the Buddha's mind, his concentration, he's inspiring Shariputra and Avalokiteshvara to have the following discussion. And that Shariputra, who again is appearing to the audience at least as being an arhat, is asking to Avalokiteshvara, how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? So here, son of lineage or child of lineage is someone who has awakened their Mahayana lineage, meaning they've developed great compassion and they're aspiring towards the Mahayana path to enlightenment. So how should such a person practice this wisdom of emptiness? And what we're going to see is that Avalokiteshvara, his reply to Shariputra can be seen as a reply in terms of how to practice this wisdom of emptiness at the various stages along the spiritual path. And we briefly looked at that spiritual path, the Mahayana path, in terms of these five stages or paths called the path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing, path of meditation, path of no more learning. And what we saw from this is that the first part of the answer, of course, that he's about to give is to look at how to practice this wisdom of emptiness along the first two stages of the path of accumulation and preparation. And on those two stages of the path, when we are reflecting and meditating on emptiness, we are having what's called a conceptual realization of emptiness, meaning that there is still a sense of me, the meditator, realizing this thing, emptiness. But it's actually a valid realization, even though it's conceptual. And of course, to have an actual realization versus just some little taste or experience, the difference being, of course, the quality of mind that we're using in our meditation. Realizations are more stable and lasting. For our meditation on emptiness to become a realization, we need a very stable, clear, and focused mind. Now, of course, if our mind is not very stable, clear, and focused, we could meditate on emptiness, we could have some experience, but that experience won't really penetrate very deeply into our mind, meaning that that experience we have in meditation may not even still affect our mind after the meditation, or it may affect it a little bit for a short time, maybe some minutes or hours, even sometimes some days. But that effect will wear off. It's not stable. So to stabilize that experience, of course, we need a very clear, focused mind. We need this mind of shamatha. So what we're doing now then is, before we go into the explanation of the practice of emptiness, we're looking at how to develop this mind of shamatha. Because even at our level, at as a beginner level, I think it's very important to put some effort into this shamatha practice. Because if we don't, then we can put a lot of effort into our emptiness practice, we can put a lot of effort into our compassion practice, all sorts of practices, and not really get much benefit because our mind is quite distracted and dull. So not only is the shamatha practice essential to make sure our other practices are more effective, but the shamatha practice in itself brings a lot of direct benefits, of course. Because the more stable, relaxed, stable and clear mind that we can develop, then of course the more effective we are in everything we do in our life, the more peaceful our mind will be, the less stressed, the less imbalances in our mind, the less mental afflictions. And also then, instead of being the slaves of our mind, often becoming overwhelmed by our thoughts, emotions and memories, and our minds being very chaotic and turbulent, through the shamatha practice, we will really start to become the masters of our mind, meaning our minds will naturally become more quiet and still. And even if some strong negative mental event comes up in our mind, we'll simply be able to be present with it and watch it arise and pass without becoming overwhelmed by it. So these are some of the immediate direct benefits of this practice as well. So we were looking at this practice, started to look at it yesterday, and so I'd like to sort of continue on where we left off. So if we can have a look at the shamatha chart again. We'll continue on from where we left off. So remember, shamatha, translated into English, is often translated as something like calm abiding. Shamatha is a particular level of concentration, a particular level of samadhi. It's the minimum level of samadhi we have to develop in the spiritual path, in the Buddhist spiritual path. Of course, there are much higher levels of concentration we can develop. In particular, these four dhyanas, which we briefly looked at yesterday, can be very helpful, very stable. And these are often emphasized, particularly within the Theravada traditions. But at least we need to develop the mind of shamatha if we are to come to have a stable and clear enough mind to come to have a direct realization of emptiness, of nature of reality. And so what we saw here so far is, you know, at the top of the second page there, it says shamatha is attained by progressing through the 9 stages, relying on the 8 antidotes to abandon the 5 faults. So we looked at these 5 faults and 8 antidotes very briefly. And we saw there that of course we overcome laziness in terms of not wanting to do the practice, then the 2 main imbalances that we are trying to correct in our practice is what's listed here as laxity and excitement. course, laxity is the technical word for a very dull mind. And excitement is the most common form of distraction. So really we're trying to overcome this sort of dull mind or a distracted mind. And so the two main tools we're using in the practice, of course, are mindfulness and introspection, which in the diagram here we saw was symbolized by the rope of mindfulness, meaning we're trying to tie our mind with the rope of mindfulness to the object. And then we have the hook of introspection, which is monitoring that mindfulness. Are we still focused on the object, or are we becoming a little bit dull, or are we becoming distracted? So it's like quality control is introspection. And if we notice that we've become dull or distracted, of course, we hook the mind back and reapply mindfulness and hold the object again. And so we began yesterday by looking at the first stage of the practice. And here we saw again that the elephant is symbolizing our mind in general. The fact that it's black is symbolizing this dullness or laxity. The monkey is symbolizing conceptual thought in general. And the fact that it's black is symbolizing this excitement. And we saw here that at the first stage of our practice there, the elephant and monkey are running wildly ahead of us. Which means that at the first stage of practice, what we really notice is how chaotic our mind is. Because often before we begin to meditate, because our mind is always focused outward, sometimes we sort of live in this illusion that our mind is not too bad. You know, that if I try to focus on the breath, I should be able to do that sort of okay. Maybe I'll get a little dull and distracted, but I think I can do that pretty well. But of course, when we try to do that, we sort of really come to realize how chaotic our minds are, how out of control they are. And so we mentioned a little bit about that yesterday, and I'd just like to add a little bit to that. Again, reading through this book, a reading from this Attention Revolution, where he actually talks about each of these stages in quite some detail. But just a couple of things from here that, again, can be some practical advice for us, particularly at the beginning stage of our practice. So this comes on page 13. And he says the following. The first of the nine stages leading to the achievement of shamatha is called directed attention. So he uses a slightly different word than settling the mind here. The sign of having reached this stage is simply being able to place your mind on your chosen object of meditation for even a second or two. If you are trying to direct your attention to a difficult object, such as a complex visualization, this may take days or weeks to accomplish. But if your chosen object is your breathing, you may achieve this stage on your first attempt. The faculty of mindfulness is crucial in shamatha practice. Mindfulness in this context differs somewhat from the way some contemporary meditation teachers present it. Vipassana teachers, for instance, commonly explain mindfulness as a moment-to-moment, non-judgmental awareness of whatever arises. In the context of shamatha, however, mindfulness refers to attending continuously to a familiar object without forgetfulness or distraction. The first stage of directed attention is achieved through the power of hearing. So each of these roads symbolizes one of these powers. So the first power is the power of hearing. And that is this road. It says, according to Buddhist tradition, the most effective way to acquire fresh learning is directly from an experienced, knowledgeable teacher. First you hear teachings, then you follow up with reading, study, and practice. The power of hearing refers both to listening to instructions and also to reading about them, especially if no qualified teacher is available. One of the first signs of progress in shamatha practice is simply noticing how chaotic our minds are. We try to remain attentive but we swiftly lose our minds and slip into absent-mindedness. People who never sit quietly and try to focus their minds may remain under the illusion that their minds are calm and collected. Only when we try to direct the attention to a single object for minutes on end does it really become apparent how turbulent and fragmented our attention is. From a Buddhist perspective, the untrained mind is afflicted with attention deficits and hyperactivity. It is dysfunctional. Like a wild elephant, the untamed mind can inflict enormous damage on ourselves and those around us. In addition to oscillating between attention deficit and hyperactivity, the normal untrained mind compulsively disgorges a toxic stream of wandering thoughts, then latches onto them obsessively, carried away by one story after another. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorders and obsessive compulsive disorders are not confined to those who are diagnosed as mentally ill. The normal mind is prone to such imbalances, and that's why normal people experience so much mental distress. Such disturbances are symptoms of an unbalanced mind. So, again, I think according to Buddhism, we're all suffering ADHD. The only difference being, of course, is that in medicine or psychology, you have to have a sort of clinically significant level before they give you some drugs. But, and so it's sort of accepted that there are normal levels of inattention and dullness, and that we can't really improve that very far. But from a Buddhist perspective, certainly within the shamatha practice, we can go way beyond what is sort of accepted within psychology or medicine in terms of attention skills. I think generally in the scientific community, it's sort of understood that attention skills cannot be really refined very far. But from a Buddhist perspective, we can go way beyond what is accepted within science and medicine. And of course, this is the practice to do that. So we all have clinically significant levels of ADHD, because anytime we have dullness or distraction, it really creates a lot of imbalances in our mind. This question.
Yeah, about that. I work in education, and I work with children with health, of course, myself, a bit more. But, so the question is, if Buddhism thinks that this is, like, from everyone has it, so how come, like, it's more common with, you know, children, you know, when they're small, not say, you know, as a society, when they're really small, you can detect that. So,
Yeah. I mean, of course, there are many factors that can contribute to these imbalances, and some of them are genetic. There are genetic factors, so some genetic factors predispose. But I think it seems like a large degree of reason why there's such an epidemic of ADHD in our modern society is environmental factors, particularly diet, you know, junk food, sugar. I mean, sugar is a disaster when it comes to ADHD. And also on top of that, I think this sort of stimulus, bombarded by stimulus, you know, the iPhones, smartphones, Facebook, this sort of constant stimulus and then sort of moving on to something else, this sort of programming. And again, I think some modern studies have shown that to give very young children iPhones and tablets and stuff is a nightmare, is a disaster for their attention skills. And so these studies say that you should not do that because it's really going to create huge problems for that young child because they're going to be end up in this situation. So, of course, there are many factors. And, of course, we need to look at these external factors and reduce the impact, like improving the diet, not getting caught up in all this stimulus, and then, of course, genetic factors, whatever we can do there. So these are things that we can work on in an external way. But on top of that, then, of course, we can do these sorts of practices to help improve at whatever level we are. And everyone is at different levels, of course. And now I think there's a lot of interest in this mindfulness shamatha style practice, and they're really tailoring these practices for people who really have these very quite extreme levels of attention deficit and hyperactivity to help them to improve that.
So what you're saying about, like, there is the theory about the left mind and the right mind, and you have this probably some of the reasons that there is this imbalance like behavior. This is something that are taught in Buddhism also. And another question, why does Buddhism, like, so Ritalin, people agree that this is like a medicine that could really help, but also, like, it depends to who.
Sure. Of course, Buddhism doesn't talk about brain and left hemisphere, right hemisphere, but my understanding is of the studies that are being done in neuroscience these days is that techniques such as meditation can help balance the two hemispheres. That's what they've seen, I think. So, but in Buddhist texts, of course, you won't see anything about brain or... and the other point was... Ritalin. Yes, I mean, if some person has extreme imbalance, then maybe as a starting point to use some medication to reduce that slightly so that they can begin to do these sorts of practices. And I've talked to a number of people who've been heavily dependent on Ritalin and medications like that, and a number of these people, through beginning to do meditation, have reduced dramatically the dependency and sometimes managed to let go of it altogether. But of course, what's not recommended is to stop taking these drugs and just meditate instead. That would be too dramatic. So I think there it would be good to, together with the doctor or physician, work out how to slowly reduce the dependency and use techniques such as this and better diet and so forth to not have reliance on those drugs, because those drugs are not really going to cure the problem. Okay. So let's now continue on. I want to finish this chart here now this morning. So if we continue to practice, then we'll get to the second stage, and that's around the corner. It's called continuous setting here. So here we see that the elephant and the monkey are not running so wildly, and now they have a little bit of white on top of their heads. And this is symbolizing these factors of stability and clarity, which means now that we're starting to develop a little bit of stability and clarity, meaning by the second stage of the practice, what you're going to notice is that there are going to be periods in your meditation where your mind settles down more, you're more stable, more clear. You can maybe even hold the object for 1 or 2 minutes before you become distracted. But even at the second stage of practice, we tend to be more distracted than we are on the object. So again, let's see, have a look at some practical advice from Alan Wallace on this point. So this again is on page 30. He says, in the second of the 9 stages, continuous attention, you experience occasional periods of continuity, but most of the time your mind is still caught up in wandering thoughts and sensory distractions. Don't be misled by the name of this stage. Continuous attention doesn't mean that you can maintain unbroken continuity for long stretches, but that now and again you can remain centered for a sustained period without completely losing track of your object of attention. However, time and again you will still lapse back into coarse excitation, completely forgetting about the intended object of attention. When you can occasionally maintain continuity of awareness of bodily sensations for about a minute, you have reached the second stage. The second stage is achieved by the power of thinking. The challenge in this phase of practice is to sustain interest in the object, and you can do this by thinking about the instructions between sessions. If you are a seasoned meditator, you've probably found that involuntary mental commentary on your practice can be an obstacle. Even the ongoing thought, here is the in-breath, here is the out-breath, can be an intrusion. However, internal commentary can also be useful, especially in the first two stages of shamatha practice. If you're thinking about the practice, at least you're not thinking about something else. Another way to use the power of thinking to help calm the distracted wandering mind is to count the breaths. This is like using training wheels when first learning to ride a bicycle. While the practice of mentally counting breaths involves a kind of thinking, it can help to simplify the conceptual mind. Instead of having many things to think about during the meditation, you reduce your thinking to just counting your breaths. It is important, though, that in striving to maintain continuous attention, you don't lose your earlier sense of relaxation. The stability of your attention should emerge from a relaxed mind, not work against it. So, here then, I think is some very practical advice, is particularly if you're the sort of person that has a lot of conceptual thoughts and really getting distracted a lot in the meditation, is that you may like to experiment with things like counting the breath. Because by counting the breath, you're tying up your mind with conceptual activity related to the practice rather than getting caught up in a lot of other conceptual thought. If you're doing counting the breath, though, we're still primarily focusing on the sensations of the breath. And only really very briefly at the end of the in-breath, you mentally count the breath, like 1, 2, 3. Of course, not verbally, mentally. And then the rest of the out-breath and in-breath, you're focusing on the sensations. So if you find counting helpful, use it. Some people find, even as a beginner, that it's distracting. So this is a tool that you can use as a beginner if you find it useful, if you're getting distracted a lot. And there are a number of ways of doing this counting. One common way is from counting mentally 1 up to 10 and then back to 1. Of course, you can just continue counting. And often it's recommended that if you somehow lose where you're up to the count, you go back to 1. And what can be done here is at a practical level is only use counting when you find that your mind is heavily distracted. Don't overuse it, because eventually you'll have to let go of it, because it is still mental activity and we're focusing on the breath. But as a beginner, if you find it helpful to use counting, then use it. Some traditions use something very similar to counting called noting the breath, meaning you mentally note, like out-breath, in breath, or breathing out, breathing in. So this can be also useful, but if you're going to use noting, again, keep it very simple. Otherwise, it'll become a commentary. You know, oh, now I'm breathing out, but it's really long this time. Why is it so long? You know? So we don't want to get into that. But if you want to use noting rather than counting, keep it very simple, like, just like out, in, or breathing out, breathing in. Not more than that. But again, only use it if you find it helpful. If you don't find it helpful, then don't use it. You may notice also in this diagram here some little like pictures in the middle of the roads. The first down the bottom, we see this bowl of fruit. So there's these five diagrams here, these five pictures, and they are symbolizing the sense objects, because it's sensory distraction, which is the most common form of distraction. So the ball of fruit here, of course, is taste. To the right of it, next to it, we see some silk cloth. So that is touch or tactile object. And then above that silk cloth, we see two round things. They are symbols. So that's sound. To the left of that, we see a shell with some perfume in it, so that's smell. And then above that, a little bit to the right, we see a round object, that is a mirror. So that is visual objects. So these are the five sense objects that are one of the most common forms of distraction in our practice. So let's move on. So if we continue to practice, we'll get around the corner into the third road. And this third road is called the power of mindfulness. So by stage 3 and 4, our mindfulness now is getting very good. And we can see that when the rope is now attached to the elephant of the mind. So by the third stage of practice, which is called resetting here, our mindfulness is getting a lot better, meaning that we can hold the object for longer periods of time, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, before we become distracted. And now when we become distracted, we quickly recognize that and come back very quickly. And so that's symbolized by the elephant turning the head backwards, meaning we come back to the object very quickly. But now we see the rabbit has come into the picture. The rabbit is symbolizing this subtle dullness or subtle laxity. So by the third stage, our mindfulness is getting quite good. We can focus on the breath quite well, 5 or 10 minutes. If we notice that we get distracted, we quickly come back. Seems like we're making dramatic progress. So even though our stability is getting quite good, our clarity is still missing. So that is symbolized by the rabbit. So now we need to notice more if our mind is very clear on the object or not. And if we don't notice that it's not very clear, then we won't, of course, correct that and we'll sort of get stuck here. So this is the rabbit. We need to start to notice now that our mind is a little bit dull and to sharpen our focus. Of course, the rabbit was there from the very beginning, but in the first 2 stages, we had much more heavy problems to deal with. But by the 3rd stage, now this is something we really need to attend to. So again, just a little bit of advice about the 3rd stage from Alan Wallace. So this is on page 43. He says the following. When you were still on the 2nd stage, although you experienced periods when your attention was continually engaged with the meditative object for as long as a minute, most of the time you are still caught up in distractions. When you reach the 3rd stage, your attentional stability has increased so that most of the time you remain engaged with the object. Occasionally there are still lapses when you completely forget the object, but you quickly recognize them and patch up these holes in the continuity of attention. Long before you achieve this stage, you may occasionally have a session in which your mind seems to remain on the object most of the time. But don't be fooled. Even amateur golfers occasionally hit a birdie, but that doesn't mean they're ready to go on the pro circuit. The 3rd stage is achieved only when your mind remains focused on the object most of the time in virtually all your sessions. For most people, the primary problem in this phase of practice is still coarse excitation, and it is with the power of mindfulness that you accomplish this 3rd stage. So what he's saying is that the gauge of to know what level you're at is what is your average experience in meditation. And so if your average experience is that normally you can hold the breath quite well, 5 or 10 minutes, and if you get distracted, you quickly come back. If that's your average experience in meditation, you're at stage 3. Sometimes you may be able to hold the breath the whole session without ever losing it. Sometimes maybe you'd be a little bit more distracted. But on average, that's your average experience. So that's what it means to be at that stage. And then a little bit more, on page 45, he says, many people appear to achieve the 2nd stage while meditating just 1 or 2 sessions a day. In their more focused sessions, they experience periods of continuity of attention. But such stability is lost during the day as they engage in other activities. Shamatha meditation can be very helpful even in the midst of a normally socially active way of life, especially when it is balanced with other kinds of spiritual practice, such as the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion. Rounded, integrated practice is like maintaining a healthy diet. While a proper diet won't necessarily heal imbalance and illness, it is still indispensable for maintaining your vitality and resistance to disease. Likewise, a balanced meditative practice in the course of a socially engaged way of life heightens your psychological immune system so that you are less vulnerable to mental imbalances of all kinds. So, again, I think what he's saying there is that whatever effort we put into this practice, and particularly if we balance this practice with things like loving kindness and compassion, then this is going to have a very positive impact on our daily life. And to maximize that positive impact, then also we need to set up our life in a supportive way, a supportive lifestyle. And I'll talk a little bit more about that right at the end of this course, this supportive lifestyle that's going to help us. Otherwise, if we just simply do some shamatha practice in the morning and then we run around as we normally do quite mindlessly, getting caught up in all sorts of stimulus, then our meditation practice, even if we really put quite some effort into it, won't really reap much benefit. So we need to make sure that we have that integrated in a supportive lifestyle. Okay. If we continue to practice, we'll get to stage four. And stage four here is called close setting. So by stage four, we can now, our mindfulness has got quite good, meaning now we can hold the object the entire session without ever completely losing it. But still, the quality of our holding needs a lot of work. Because you may have even noticed now, you can sort of focus on your breath and think about breakfast at the same time. So you have a lot of this sort of background noise there. So that's not very good quality of holding. So even at stage four, you'll find that there's still quite a lot of this background noise, and also our mind sometimes is a little bit dull as well. So then what we find around the next corner, the next road, is this power of introspection. So now, stage five and six, we now see the hook is more prominent, meaning that stage five and six, introspection's job is not so much noticing when we're half asleep or completely distracted, but noticing the quality of our attention. And here, the analogy used is often the guitar string analogy, meaning if a guitar string is too tight or too loose, it doesn't play well. Meaning if our mind is too tight or too loose, it doesn't focus well. If our mind is too loose or relaxed, we tend to become dull. If our mind is too tight, we become agitated. So what we need to do is balance our attention. And so this is what introspection is doing here, is noticing when our mind is too tight or too loose, meaning becoming a bit dull or a bit agitated, and then adjusting the focus. This balancing act. And this balancing act, of course, I think is something that can be very helpful for us as the beginning phase as well. Because now we tend to drift into either being completely dull or just completely distracted. And so particularly if we're using the breath as the object, in a practical way, we can do this balance on every breath, meaning when we are breathing out, this is a good natural time to relax, to release any tension, and of course to let go of any distractions, and then to come back to the breath. So this is a good opportunity to, again, overcome tightness and distraction. Relax, release, return. And then the in-breath is a very natural opportunity to sharpen our focus, to overcome dullness. So we can do this balancing act on every breath. So actually, a single breath can be an entire meditation, doing that balance. Particularly, again, if we're using the breath as the actual object. So again, on the out-breath, relax, release, return, and on the in-breath, sharpen the focus. to balance that mind. One thing here I'd like to mention, we see number 19, we see a monkey in the tree holding some fruit. And if we look over to the description, it says, since virtuous thoughts are an interruption at the time of shamatha meditation, it is necessary to stop them. At other times, it is not necessary. And this is going to happen to us, is that as we do the shamatha practice, our mind is becoming more stable and clear and calm. And as I mentioned briefly the other day, then often a lot of ideas pop up when this happens, you know. That's when we really are creative and a lot of good ideas come up. You know, it's like the example of, you know, we're at work and there's a very difficult problem and all day we've been trying to work this out problem. Nothing happened. We go to sleep and then 3 o'clock in the morning we wake up and the solution's there. Because our mind, of course, in sleep is very calm and still, and then the solution can pop up. So you're going to notice this also in the shamatha practice, is that a lot of these sort of good ideas will pop up. But the recommendation, of course, is not to get caught up in these ideas. Because our mind can say, oh, but it's something very virtuous. You really need to pay attention to this now. And so then, of course, we just get caught up in it and we justify getting caught up because it's a good thing. But here's the advice here, is don't do that. So what you can do, of course, if some great idea pops up, is just mentally quickly note to yourself and go, great, this is a good idea. I'll look at that after the meditation and just let it go. And if you're really worried about forgetting it, you can have a little notepad next to you and just jot down a key word. And then come back to your meditation. So you can let go of it. Otherwise, you're going to get caught up in it. So virtuous thoughts, these ideas, is shamatha practice, in the middle of shamatha practice, is not the right time to attend to them. Attend to them after the meditation. So that's what's being suggested here. Then, of course, if we continue our practice, we'll get round to the next road, which is translated here as the power of effort. Or we could actually say also the power of enthusiasm. Meaning now we're very enthusiastic about the practice, and actually it becomes more or less effortless. So we have number 24 and 25 here in the description, which says, at this stage it is difficult for subtle laxity and excitement to arise, and even if they do arise a little, they are immediately eliminated with the slightest effort. So we see here that the rabbit is gone, saying goodbye to the monkey, not much black left on the elephant. And then if we go to stage 8, it says, number 25, the black color of the elephant is gone and there is no monkey. This means that in dependence upon initially applying a little mindfulness and introspection, the mind can engage continuously in concentration without any potential of being interrupted by laxity, excitement, or thoughts. So then, by stage 8 of the practice, all we need to do is a little bit of effort to start the meditation, and then it flows more or less effortlessly. And the amount of effort we have to put into our practice is represented by the flame. So we see down the bottom, the first couple of stages, the flame is very big. By the time we get round here to stage 7, 8, 9, the flame is completely gone. Meaning we don't need to put effort into maintaining mindfulness. Mindfulness and introspection are so well developed that they're really spontaneous, that we can focus very easily on the object without a lot of this effort. And then we get to stage 9. In the cave here, which is called setting in equipoise. Now, the equipoise, of course, means balance. Now our mind is completely balanced, free of any subtle laxity, subtle excitation or distraction, and everything becomes completely spontaneous and effortless. But we still haven't got to shamatha. And shamatha is the next diagram in the middle at the top, where we see the meditator on the back of the elephant and flying through the sky. So this is shamatha, and it's symbolizing what's called this pliancy we talked about briefly before. that the mind and body becomes completely serviceable and flexible. That it's said that when we achieve shamatha, the body feels light like cotton. Hence we symbolize by the person flying through the sky. And now the mind is completely flexible, meaning we have no resistance from our mind at all. We can turn our mind to whatever we want without any resistance. And that is symbolized by the person resting, sitting on the back of the elephant of the mind, meaning we're complete control of our mind now. So let's have a look at how we actually achieve shamatha, and then we'll take a morning tea break. So this is on page 155. So he describes very clearly how we actually achieve shamatha. He says, following the realization of the ninth attentional balance after months or years of continuous full-time practice, you are primed to achieve shamatha. The nine preceding stages entail many incremental changes, but the actual accomplishment of shamatha involves a radical transition in your body and mind. You will be like a butterfly emerging from its cocoon. This shift is characterized by specific experiences that take place within a discrete, relatively brief period of time. According to accounts from the Indo-Tibetan tradition of Buddhism, the first sign of the achievement of shamatha is the experience of a sense of heaviness and numbness on the top of the head. This allegedly happens to anyone who experiences this transition, regardless of the specific method followed. It is said to feel as if a palm were being placed on the top of your head. It is not unpleasant or harmful, just unusual. Something remarkable must be taking place in the cortical region of your brain at this point, but so far no one has monitored the brain correlates of this shift using magnetic resonance imaging or an electroencephalograph. This physical sensation on the top of the head is symptomatic of a shift in your nervous system or network of vital energies that is correlated by gaining freedom from mental dysfunction, a general state of mental imbalance characterized by stiffness, rigidity, and unwieldiness. Consequently, you achieve a state of mental pliancy in which your mind is fit and supple like never before. From a contemplative perspective, when the mind is dysfunctional or prone to laxity and excitation, it is hard to generate enthusiasm for healing the afflictions of your mind or for devoting yourself to virtuous mental activity. Once you are free of such mental dysfunction, you can focus your mind without resistance on any meaningful object or task, and such a mind is now set to be fit or serviceable. This is the key to achieving optimal mental performance. Following this sense of pressure on the top of your head, you experience the movement of vital energies moving through your body, and when they have coursed everywhere throughout your body, you feel as if you are filled with the power of this dynamic energy. You are now freed from physical dysfunction, so your body feels buoyant and light like never before, and hence the person flying through the sky. Both your body and mind are now imbued with an exceptional degree of pliancy, which makes them remarkably fit for engaging in all kinds of mental training and other meaningful activities. When physical pliancy initially arises, the vital energies catalyze an extraordinary sense of physical bliss, which then triggers an equally exceptional experience of mental bliss. This rush of physical and mental rapture is transient, which is a good thing, for it so captivates the attention you can do little else except enjoy it. Gradually it subsides, and you are freed from the turbulence caused by this intense joy. Your attention settles down in perfect stability and vividness. You have now achieved shamatha. Sounds pretty good, huh? There's a couple more things I want to finish off here on this chart, but I see it's time for morning tea break, so let's have morning tea break and come back at 10:45.